I had several pages of introduction as far as Norman Cousins is concerned, but I'm going to be simple and direct and give you the one page that I slaved over to make sure I told you all the important things about this illustrious gentleman. When your planning committee first met and pooled our ideas for this convention, the words which most epitomized us and our needs was communicators and communications. The thrust of our program during the next 2 days will be toward the communication of religion through as many varied ways as possible. Who then would be our keynote speaker? Who was our A number one choice? The decision was unanimous, Norman Cousins. Except for 2 years, Mr. Cousins has been editor of the Saturday Review since 1942. And through that magazine, he has heightened his more than a half million readers' awareness of literature, science, theater, dance, music, sociology, history, and especially through the editorial page, where he has initiated such programs as the Hiroshima Maidens in 1955, bringing disfigured Japanese women to this country for plastic surgery, and similar treatment for the Polish Catholic women mutilated by the Nazi medical experimenters during World War II. He initiated care for the Hiroshima orphan children and headed the aid to Biafran children. Norman Cousins communicates. He has written 10 books, the newest of which is Celebration of Life, published by Harper and Row, and he has edited 4 others. He has lectured in Japan, Australia, the Philippines, Singapore, India, Ceylon, Pakistan, Indonesia, West Germany, Finland, Ethiopia, the Soviet Union, Poland, and Romania. I'm not sure what's left in the world, but I imagine he'll get there. Mr. Cousins has been recognized with awards and degrees from 32 colleges and universities. He received the personal medallion of Pope John XXIII in 1963 for his part in the successful negotiations with Premier Nikita Khrushchev, leading to the release from prison of Joseph Cardinal Slippage of the Ukraine and Archbishop J. Brun of Czechoslovakia. The last official act of U Thant in leaving his post as Secretary General of the UN was to award Mr. Cousins the Peace Medal of the United Nations. Norman Cousins is president of the World Association of World Federalists, which is working for world peace through law and order, and honorary president of World Federalists USA. In his spare time, Mr. Cousins pursues photography, tennis, golf, baseball, chess, and when no one is around, I understand he likes to play the organ and the piano. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the communicator par excellence, Norman Cousins.
PDU and officers, friends, you know this would be a good time to be buried, but thank you for the introduction.
It's all right.
Matter of fact, I think of an introduction in Nashville. Is there anyone here from Nashville? The introduction took place in Memphis. When at a teacher's convention, the person who was introducing me said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have dreadful news for you tonight. The speaker originally scheduled for this evening will not be heard." Excuse me. Only 3 days ago, she continued, "We got word that Mr. Stewart was ill, would be unable to be with us, and it became the unhappy task of your committee to select a substitute speaker." "This was not easy," she said. "We tried to get the very best we could. We tried to get John Gunther, but he was too expensive. We next tried to get Vincent Sheehan, but he was in Singapore." "Well," she said, "with only 36 hours to go, your committee really became desperate." "But," she continued, "Mr. Myers of the lecture committee told us not to worry because he had a friend in New York who was obligated to him." And she said he gave me a copy of his latest book to read. And she held it up. She said, "I've read it. I'm sure you have too." And then she was inspired to ask the question. "Tell me," she said, "how many of you have read this book?" Well, it was a very honest group. I perked up when she asked the question, then perked down when I saw just two hands. And she realized the situation was one that had to be retrieved. She was quite equal to it. And she said, "Well, I'm absolutely certain that you're all going to read the book, aren't you? No hands, please." In any event, she said, "I'm very pleased to present to you tonight the editor of the Saturday Evening Post." Well, of course, with all that camouflage, you didn't have to worry about the talk you were going to give. Seriously, I've been asked to talk about the American Founding Fathers in a contemporary setting. I suppose it would be presumptuous of anyone to attempt to say what any given group of men would think or do in a given situation at another period in history. But in this case, we've been favored by the most unambiguous set of ideas and personal philosophies, I think, that have ever been recorded. I can't think of any exchange of letters that was as wide-ranging, intellectually stimulating, and candid as the exchange between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams in their retirement. In the last year or so, I've been putting these letters together, if you want a guide to government or philosophy or even the relevance of religion in the modern world, I think you'll find it in the correspondence of Adams and Jefferson. Bringing in, of course, their collateral correspondence with Benjamin Rush and Priestley, a large part of that correspondence was concerned with religious matters. And they were deeply interested and involved in the place of religion, not just for their time, but in all time. There's been an impression, or at least there once was when I went to school, that the American Founding Fathers were not deeply religious men. I remember, for example, the remark made by, Theodore Roosevelt about Thomas Paine. You recall that remark, "That filthy little atheist." But since Tom Paine and Thomas Jefferson and Madison and Adams and Franklin tended to be a community of belief, did this mean that Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Franklin were filthy atheists too? And so I went back over their letters and their writings and their talks, and this served as a book that I published about 20 years ago called In God We Trust, The Religious Beliefs of the American Founding Fathers. And the title was not just a carryover from the slogan one finds on coins, but a specific and eloquent expression of the fact that these were deeply religious men. Now, their struggle was against the church, but it's the kind of struggle I think that we would respect, because they were against the attempt of any organization to invade or curtail personal freedoms or religious freedoms. And when they looked at the old world, they were looking at a situation in which government and church were intertwined. and where the authority of the church was used in order to circumscribe the political and religious liberty of peoples. And so when they spoke about religious freedom, this did not mean that they were speaking about freedom from religion. When they spoke about religious freedom, they were talking about the need and the sacred right of each individual to have unlimited and unobstructed access to the deity. They were talking about a situation in which religion would not be used as the pretext for curtailing political freedom. They were deeply religious men, and they believed that a religious authority could inhibit their religions, or at least their pursuit of their religious beliefs. But it was so significant that here in Philadelphia, in 1787, at that very first session of the Constitutional Convention, that they began the meeting with an invocation. And the term and the slogan, "In God We Trust," was natural to them. So as I say, we had a group here of men who were deeply spiritual in their outlook. And they had, I believe, a rather exalted idea of the capacity of human beings. I think it's useful to remind ourselves of their view of what a human being was, because today I think that people in this country tend to be divided increasingly into two groups. And this is a basic division that transcends party affiliation. I don't think that the most important division is between Democrats and Republicans. Thank you very much. I've got a little laryngitis, and the other night in Chapel Hill, the chairman, thinking to make things easier for me, said to the audience, "Please be kind, our speaker comes to us tonight with a clogged head."
Doing well.
I was saying that the essential division is not between Democrats and Republicans. I think the essential division of our time has to do with a view of life between those who look out at the range of problems affecting the human race and do not believe that human beings have the intellectual, political, or spiritual capacity to meet their problems, and they become despairing, and those on the other side, the party of the second part, those who are looking at the same range of problems feel that there is no problem that concerns human beings that is beyond the reach of human beings to understand and to solve. And so there's a religious dimension, it seems to me, in the crisis before the country at the time. The American Founding Fathers, I think, belonged to the party of the second part. It was that view of the limitless capacity of human beings, a view of human beings as belonging to a species which can do something for the first time. And this is what makes human beings unique. In our own age, as I say, though, the party of the first part, the party of despair, is growing. One can understand the circumstances. We've been through 10 years in which the kind of government that the American Founding Fathers thought would be without challenge, has fallen from grace. We've been through 10 years in which specific ideas in the Constitution designed to protect Americans from the arbitrary exercise of power have been abused, in which government itself has become incapable, demonstrably incapable, of making moral judgments. And the result of all this has been to produce a sort of existential despair among the American people. We think back to Germany at the end of World War I. We think back to philosophers like Heidegger, whose works were used at that time, and Kierkegaard, to justify the withdrawal of the individual because of the intrusion of society. We think of the despair that existed among the intellectuals in Germany at the time, and we think of a similar situation that existed in France at the end of World War II, where you had not only the writings of Kierkegaard and Heidegger and Jaspers, but also Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus, even though the latter two resisted attempts to be described as existentialists, but nonetheless their works served that purpose. And you think of writings like No Exit and The Fall, and once again in France, as in Germany, the individual tended to draw a circle around himself to prevent the invasion of society and to enable him to function intellectually and spiritually without that oppressive pressure. But the trouble there, of course, was that once you draw a circle around yourself to protect things from coming in, you can't get out either. And this made for intellectual isolation and the kind of despair that Paul Tillich wrote about. And in our time, it seems to me that the events of the past 10 years have tended to promote an American existentialism, negative existentialism, where individuals retreat, withdraw, where they draw the circle around themselves, but this makes for individual isolation. Society can't get in, but then the individual doesn't affect the society. The despair produces hopelessness, and the hopelessness produces helplessness. And over it all is a deep feeling of cynicism, and out of cynicism there will come no energy. I believe the American Founding Fathers would attempt to summon the American people to a more open view of themselves, of their society, of their future. I believe the American Founding Fathers would be profoundly disconcerted by contemporary events. I think that they would probably point to certain key decisions that went into the general process of disintegration and from that dissolution. I think they would point to a decision made in 1957 to 58 with respect to the formation of a group that would operate outside the Constitution of the United States, operate abroad to subvert other governments, to operate secretly, and to attempt to create counter-revolutionary forces. They would listen to the argument that we needed a CIA because the Russians were doing it and therefore we had to do it, and I think they would say, you don't imitate the enemy. You hold to your own values. And if there are things you object to, make them explicit, make them visible, make them dramatic, and fight for them, but don't join the enemy. I think they would be appalled at the notion that the United States or the American people would be involved in assassination, intrigue, and subversion. I think they would say that the Constitution was a specific attempt to limit power, and that therefore these efforts were explicitly unconstitutional. The notion that the United States might be involved in a war in Vietnam is something that I think would have sat very heavily on their hearts. They would have diagnosed that, and they would have traced it back to the pivotal beginnings. And what were those pivotal beginnings? Well, in 1958, after the French left Indochina, there was a vacuum, a power vacuum in Indochina, and the United States was afraid that this vacuum would be filled by the Chinese communists. And we had the domino idea that if one of those countries fell, it would lead to the fall of other countries. And so we decided that we were going to do what we could to bolster those countries, but our knowledge was not equal to our intentions. We made a ghastly mistake in Laos, for example. In Laos, the first constitutional government was elected under Souvanaphouma, but we needed Thailand as a military base. And when the region of Thailand told us that his son-in-law, Phumi Nosavan, would make a much better ruler in Laos, and we need not worry because the people of Laos, after all, were largely illiterate, and that Phumi Nosavan could stage a coup, and the coup would last 4 hours, and this would help to consolidate the southern tier because it would mean that Laos and Thailand, where we had our base, would be more closely related. And so the United States backed the overthrow of the first constitutional government in Laos against Souvanaphouma. As I say, our knowledge was not very great. The people may have been illiterate, but they were not stupid. There is the literacy of the ear and the mouth, and not just of the eye and the hand. And they decided to fight for their government. And out of that miscalculation came 2 years of warfare, 37,000 people killed, and also the strengthening of the communist forces in Laos, and once again another country was divided north and south. It didn't happen as the script provided. And that same miscalculation was to extend elsewhere. Incidentally, in Laos, the American people were financing a revolution. Since officially we were pledged to the support of the Savannah government, and undercover, we were supporting the rebellion under Phumi Nosavan. That meant that both sides turned to the United States for uniforms, both sides turned to the United States for ammunition, both sides turned to the United States for guns, and every 2 weeks, the paymasters would come to the United States and receive pay for their army. So the United States was financing a civil war out of very simple beginnings. And then the rest of Indochina, I remember when I was out there talking to some of our military people, and they said, you know, we can't be advisors here because the governments pay no attention to us. And all over this area, people are saying the United States doesn't have the will to fight. And not until we say that we really mean it will they pay any attention to us. The Philippines are looking at us, wondering whether we have the will to do anything about communism. The Burmese are looking at us. The Japanese are looking at us. And we've got to demonstrate that we mean it. And so, as I say, we were taunted and goaded into demonstrating our masculinity without any really real understanding what the issue itself was. Self-government went by the boards, and step by step, we found ourselves in a situation where the only issue became the ability of the United States to demonstrate that no one could push us around. What else were we fighting for, except the fact that since we were committed, we had to win? And what honor is there in that situation? Well, I think that the American founding fathers would look at that as the end of the road, or as the specific effect of what happened when, in 1957 and 58, we decided that it wasn't in our interest to do that which was utterly repugnant to the original ideals of the American Revolution and the American Constitution. This government has been unconstitutional. I think the American Founding Fathers, looking at the world today, would ask us why we are not more mindful of our own heritage with respect to the essential problems it faces. They would tell us, I suppose, that we're celebrating the wrong date, that the 1976 is not the 200th birthday of this country, that this country was not born until 1789, and that between 1776 and 1789, there was an awful lot of history that we seem to be ignoring now. And I think they would point to the period between 1783 to 1787 as the critical period of American history, which is also the title of a book by the historian John Fiske. And I think they would say that if we ponder the events and the lessons of those years, 1783 to 1787, we would have a much clearer idea of what the foreign policy of this country ought to be today. In 1783, the American states, having officially signed the Treaty of Paris, which produced the separation with Britain, the states went their own way. Each of the states regarded itself as a sovereignty. Each of the states insisted on making its own decisions about what its conduct would be outside its own borders. New York and New Jersey shot it out in the harbor over the right to tax the incoming ships. Pennsylvania and New Jersey fought it out over the border, the precise demarcation of the border. Massachusetts and Connecticut couldn't agree over the rights to the Western Territories. No doubt Connecticut wanted that Western Territories an outlet for its surplus population, and Massachusetts was thinking of its exports. One's currency would shrink 10% just in the act of crossing a state line. And in 4 years, the gains of the Revolution were being liquidated, precisely because there was a wrong way to go about organization of nations and a right way to go about the organization of nations. And the American states were going about it in a wrong way so that the gains of freedom were being jeopardized. And that was why they came here together in Philadelphia in 1787. It was a long time after 1776. But when they came together in 1787, the first thing they did was to appraise what had gone wrong in 1783. And then they began to construct certain principles with respect to the relationships of nations to one another, or states to one another. The states at that time were really nations here. And the Constitution was a specific attempt to define a structure which gave the states a legitimate sphere of activity, but recognized too that in their relationships with one another, the freedoms of the citizens would be jeopardized unless the states had to hold a certain standards. And I think the American Founding Fathers would look at the world today and say that you cannot expect to have peace with all these absolute sovereignties defining for themselves what their conduct is to be in the world arena. The result, they would say, will be anarchy and war. They would look at the kind of power available to the nations today and would say that we don't have too much time to define the relationships of nations in a way that can make them responsible of peoples to the human race as a whole. I think they would say that what is being ignored in the world today is the human interest, and that the national interest is being put ahead of the human interest. And they would say that this is antithetical to the entire history of America, because they were interested in the creation of this government as a specific means of serving human beings, as a specific means of creating the conditions under which the natural rights of human beings could exist and indeed prosper. I doubt that the American Founding Fathers would feel that our role at the United Nations is to be determined within a very narrow band whether we should take the stump as Patrick Moynihan did and give them hell, or whether we ought to ignore what the other nations are doing. And what's not, I think they would say, it's not a matter of being soft or being tough, it's a matter of being wise. It's also a matter of asking ourselves, what kind of world organization do we need in order to serve the human interest on earth? I think they would say that the life support system in this world is running down. I think they would say that the entire human race is locked within a single geographic unit, that we now have a common destiny. I think they would say that the common needs of all human beings on earth are much greater than any of the other distractions, whatever those whatever labels may be attached to those distractions. And I think they would say that there is a basic historical principle that obtains, that states within a geographic unit must unite or fight. They said this in 1787. I don't think they would be slowed up by the size of the present geographic unit, because Hamilton, in one of the Federalist Papers, said that the larger the unit, the more essential it is if the parts of that unit have no defined relationship to the whole. What are the consequences today of breakdown? The consequences are measured in terms of an issue of the most profound significance to anyone who takes a spiritual view of life. I believe the Pope John was correct when he said in his Parchment Terris encyclical that the next war, if it comes, will not be a war by nation against nation or man against man, but a war by man against God, because it is now within the means of man to pulverize that which is God's. This next war will pursue future generations. I don't think that any generation has the right to condemn future generations. This next war, if it comes, will invade human germplasm and produce the kind of biological condemnation that has never before been experienced. I don't think the Founding Fathers would be indifferent to that particular situation. Nothing that we make on earth is in as great abundance as destructive force. We have 30,000 pounds of destructive force equivalent in reserve for every man, woman, and child in the world. We don't have 30,000 pounds of food in reserve for every human being in the world, or 30,000 pounds of medicine or books or any of the things that ennoble life, but we have 30,000 pounds of destructive force for every human being on earth. How do you think the American Founding Fathers would react to that? Their basic concern was with power, with the abuse of power. This is what brought them together. Would they be enthralled with that kind of power? Or would they say that no human beings could be entrusted with that kind of power? I think that the American Founding Fathers would have been inspired and exhilarated by the landing of the men on the moon, but I think they would probably say that the most significant thing that took place in that moon voyage was not that men set foot on the moon, but that they set eye on the earth. That they were able for the first time to take in the whole of the world with the human eye. And so for the first time they were able to develop a perspective on life and the human condition. And I think they would have said that from that vantage point in space, we could look around and try to contemplate the fact that only in this beautiful wet blue ball visible from that moon, only in that, on that wet blue ball in the solar system, did you have the millions upon millions of factors in precise and exquisite combination that made sacred life possible. And being the beneficiaries of this bounty, what were human beings doing? They were turning their principle, their main energies, into making the life uninhabitable. And this is what will happen if there is another war. So I think that the American Founding Fathers would find a profound spiritual dimension to the current crisis of our times. I don't think they would be dispirited. I don't think they would be despairing. I don't think they would have a feeling of hopelessness and helplessness. I think they would begin, as they did then, with the belief that human beings can do anything for the first time, and that we can create peace for the first time, a real peace for the first time. And we can make this world and everything in it safe and fit for human habitation. I think their basic philosophical approach would be that this world and everything in it belongs to the people who inhabit it. And that it is possible to create on earth those conditions which make it unnecessary for human beings to kill or be killed at the order of governments. I think they would see the world as a geographic unit, and they would do everything they could to bring order to that particular unit. And as it concerns American foreign policy, I think they would say that the principal objective of American foreign policy, the underlying objective of American foreign policy, should be to give the United Nations the authority to enact and enforce world law in the cause of peace. And I think they would talk about the need for a responsible division in the United Nations. They would be appalled at the voting procedure in the General Assembly with a one nation, one vote method of representation, under which two nations with a combined population of 250,000 could outvote a nation with 200 million. I think they would be appalled at the way the Security Council was structured. And I think they would say that there is a science to government, and that we cannot have peace without order in the world, and you cannot have order without law, and you cannot expect the United Nations to function unless you have codification, unless you have due process and balance of powers. And I think they would say it's far more difficult than it ever has been before, but they would say this is the need. Let us not be hypnotized by the difficulty. Let us address ourselves to the need. This is what they were like. And I see no reason why the present generation of Americans should detach themselves from that kind of philosophy. And I see every reason, indeed, why those who are concerned with the spiritual nature of human beings, the parties of the second part, as I said, those who belong to the party of the second part, I see every reason why those who belong to this party, and I'm speaking about you, I see every reason why you, in 1976, and for as far ahead as anyone can see, shouldn't derive the kind of inspiration from what happened in this country two centuries ago. Whether or not it is our precise birthday makes a little difference. I see no reason why you shouldn't derive enough inspiration and energy in the vast outreach that you have to remind people that human beings are capable of meeting their needs, and that the kind of approach to life, spiritual, wise, enlightened, rational, that the American Founding Fathers exemplified can yet help the American people to find a position of true leadership in the world. I don't think that the American Founding Fathers would be bashful about the term moral leadership. I don't think that they would shrink from the recognition that in every crisis there is a deep moral dimension. I think they would see that moral dimension and be equal to it. I think that they would not be too enamored of the pessimists and the cynics. I think they would say that no man really knows enough to, or woman knows enough to be a pessimist. I think they would look at the predictions of the Club of Rome with respect to a disaster in 30 to 50 years, and they would say, well, this computer model is interesting, but the fact of the matter is that you cannot computerize, or you cannot program a computer for minds like Thomas Jefferson or Bucky Fuller, and that this world can be equal to its needs. In short, I think that what we need more than anything else in this country today is not more petroleum or manganese or any of the raw materials. I think what we need in this country more than anything else is inspiration. I think that you deal with it. Thank you.